Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by Equine Muscle Massage Therapy by Jan Barson, and she can be reached at 631-862-1402. Tonight's guest is David Yonkin, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
And good evening, Fran. You know, we've all been listening to the news lately, and I don't know if it's just me, but certainly most people recognize that there's this proliferation of killings that are going on. I mean, they happen in workplaces, and they're happening in schools, and obviously, you know, in movie theaters, and just out in the streets. I guess we can come up with theories. I mean, it's symptomatic of society today. But it always gets me thinking about whether or not, I mean, obviously these people have absolute disregard for human life. And I know that psychologists, you know, often pick these mass murderers apart psychologically. But I wonder how many actually, you know, believe in an afterlife.
Well, maybe some do. And that's why a lot of times you see somebody murder a spouse and then they take their own life.
Yeah, but certainly, you know, if you believe... Well, if you believe in an afterlife, I mean, just believing or hoping that there's a heaven and a hell is certainly not a deterrent, you know, to these people. I mean, they don't sit before they act and say, well, if I kill all these people, I'm going to hell. Or maybe they do, and it just, you know, and it doesn't faze them.
Or maybe they don't believe in it at all.
Yeah, I wonder if there's ever been a study of, you know, of atheists, you know, versus, you know, non-atheists that do these things. But the point is, I wonder if somebody had a deep personal experience, you know, an afterlife encounter, you know, a near-death experience. If somebody that had this deep, let's call it a spiritual experience, could they then, you know, commit these acts? I mean, the first thing that a lot of people recognize, I mean, take the near-death experiences, is that they feel connected. They see a greater purpose in life, you know. So, I don't know whether somebody has ever, you know, committed an atrocity like that that's had a near-death experience. I would tend to doubt it.
I would tend to doubt that, too. But then you have people who have had, you hear them talk about hearing voices, negative voices, and that's what compelled them to do what they did.
So it's possible that some of these people that we automatically consider to be mentally deranged or mad... may have had experiences they didn't know how to integrate into their lives, so they
were coming from a darker place.
Right.
I mean, we do recognize that there is this hierarchy of lightness or enlightenment on the other side, and that people who were evil and performed evil deeds are way down at the bottom in the shadows, and so you have to at least acknowledge that evil exists, and evil has to exist along with goodness, otherwise you don't appreciate goodness. How do you know what goodness is if there's no evil?
What strikes out at you is that, you know, the people actually turn off empathy. They have no empathy in their lives, you know, and I just keep thinking that, you know, that sense of interconnectedness that can that you can gain from a personal experience, you know, brings along empathy. And if more of us had more empathy for each other, then, you know, it sounds very altruistic, and we're certainly not living in a utopian society.
I was just going to say, we're living in a culture that is oriented around materialism and more materialism and more materialism, and who has the most toys when they die wins, and that kind of thinking, where it is all about material things, moves you totally away from your connectiveness to...
Also, look, I mean, a lot of people that think in reductionist terms, I mean, they believe that we're really robots, you know, that our consciousness is the result of electrochemical processes in the brain. So therefore, what does it matter? You know, there are no repercussions. This is just an illusion. So it doesn't really matter if you go out and rape and pillage, because there are no after effects of that. And I agree that we do, in one sense, I mean, we seem to be making strides with more people talking about their experiences. On the other hand, we seem to be cultivating a whole new generation of materialist, you know, reductionist thinking.
I think you're seeing a divide between the two. I think you really see, and this is part of that shift. I think that if there were a way to take some sort of a measurement over how many people were more spiritual 10 years ago, I do agree we're moving more and more towards more gadgets, more things, more materialistic things that we can latch onto, but I'm saying less and less people are taking those things seriously. Like today, you pretty much have to have a cell phone. Do you have to keep it on all the time? No. Do you have to be calling people all the time? No. Do you have to be checking your emails on it all the time? No. And I think that that's where you're seeing it. You have to have it, but you don't have to be stuck with it or in that mode with it. So there, you can have it both ways.
Well, we shall see. And, you know, perhaps our guest tonight will have some thoughts on that subject. And when we come back from the break, we are going to be talking with somebody who certainly has a lot of opinions, both as a professional psychotherapist and also involved in spiritual matters. So stay with us. When we come back, we will be talking with our guest tonight, David Yonkin.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is atransc.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is David Yonkin. Our sponsor is Equine Muscle Massage Therapy by Jan Barson, and she could be reached via phone at 631-862-1402. Bob?
And David Yonkin has a master's in clinical social work from New York University. He's in private practice as a licensed and credentialed psychotherapist. He also happens to have a bunch of other degrees and certifications in music, art history, fine arts, computer graphics, and journalism. David also has a deeply spiritual side, and he explores and studies various meditational and contemplative techniques in his own life and in his therapy practice. For many years, David has been working with other professionals in research and development in the area of paranormal phenomena and has written and published in this area. The website is davidyonkin.com, that's David, Yonkin.com, and another recommended site for reasons we'll discuss later is therisenbooks.com. Welcome, David.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here. How are you?
Good, and glad to have you with us. You know, as you know, I was, both Fran and I were especially interested in your work in psychotherapy because we know that you personally have a great interest in parapsychology. Now, we know, and I've discussed this with you, that we're often told by people that they're very fearful about certain experiences they have. They have these occurrences, they don't understand them. Is fear a common reaction to experiences that one cannot explain?
I would say, yeah, unfortunately, but also I would say it doesn't have to be the only response. It might be a reaction to it at first. We often fear the unknown, especially if we don't have a lot of information about what's going on or it's not seemingly giving us any information about what's happening. So in say, paranormal experiences or whatever you want to title it, people are experiencing something very new, very foreign, very alien, very spooky for the first time. They have no information. And they have a reaction, which is a kind of a fear reaction. Unfortunately, people haven't learned how to respond to it in a way that would be calm, appropriate, curious, open, aware, to invite more of the same. And so it's a stress reaction, an anxiety reaction in many ways to the unfamiliar. But as we get more information, anxiety goes down, fear goes down. So in these experiences, it almost seems counterintuitive, like someone sees something and they go, ghost, and they're going to run away. But really, you want to go towards it, or you want to sit still and invite it closer in some way.
Mm. Now, we've been told by many people that they have gone to, you know, some of your colleagues and mental health professionals, and they've talked about having after-death communications and encounters, and they also report that the professional treated the symptoms as if it was a sign of mental illness. So is that a fair statement? I mean, do a lot of people in your profession have that reductionist thinking where they refuse to acknowledge that possibly these things are real?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And often because they're afraid of being singled out or ostracized or criticized in some way. But I'm sure if you got them alone privately, many therapists do intensive work over the years. They go to their own therapy, their own analysis, and they have all kinds of mysterious experiences on the cognitive level. But in our Western society, we're really not open to those kinds of experiences. So a lot of people are trained to, quote-unquote, respect other cultural viewpoints that could be paranormal or whatever, but for us to have the same wouldn't be acceptable. So a lot of people who, say, come to me in my practice, sooner or later, some of them might feel comfortable enough just to say, oh, I had this very strange experience, and I feel kind of uncomfortable about talking about it, but no, let's explore and hear about it. So if it's accepted without judgment, without criticism, with curiosity, more information will come forth, and then people will start becoming more comfortable with the idea. But to circle back to your original question, yeah, I think a lot of therapists, in my experience, have that conflict of wanting to join in and accept it, but are afraid to. And, of course, you've seen this, as I have, amongst other disciplines, too, like scientists who have had experiences about near death or afterlife, that they too are very afraid of being ostracized by their community because of it.
Mm. Now, I mean, you've done a lot of self-exploration, and I know that you have an intuitive side. So it must be difficult as you try to integrate the two. I mean, as your patients are talking about some of their feelings and some of their experiences, I would imagine that your professional protocol has to be affected by what you're seeing and feeling and hearing.
So I guess
the question would be, I mean, how do you integrate that?
Well, what is it? What are you integrating with? What are you integrating?
Well, in other words, on the one side, you have somebody that is familiar with the protocol of a psychotherapist and traditional means of treatment. On the other hand, you may be seeing or hearing things involving the patient that have nothing to do with your professional training. So, you know, I mean, does the psychotherapist side and the intuitive side clash at all?
Maybe if I were the kind of therapist that was trying to be very strict and adhering to some kind of a theory-based model of treatment, and I have access to all kinds of models of therapeutic interventions, and they all have their positives and negatives. But over the years, I've developed my own approach, my own intuitive approach, and that's something that has to, either you're born with that or you're developed. I remember years ago, a supervisor pointed out to me, she said, you know, you're an intuitive therapist, and there aren't many of them around them. You seem to know what to say and what to do and how to respond without referring to some sort of a black and white outline that's provided for people. And so that sensitivity of mine helps me receive the information that I'm hearing from the patient and reflecting back if it seems like an appropriate way to do so. It's sort of an intuitive way for me. I don't know how it is for other therapists.
Well, when we talk about intuition, there's usually it can be very subtle, and people often question, you know, when they receive information intuitively, you know, am I really getting it from another source? Is it coming from my subconscious? You know, am I somehow making it up or imagining it? So do you have any advice that you might give to people that are facing this so they can help discern the difference between, you know, their intuition and somehow their own thoughts?
Well, it seems like I guess if you looked at a dictionary definition of intuition and then instinct, they pretty much seem to be the same. But I've wondered often if there is a difference, and it seems to me they have a lot in common, that maybe there's just two different words for the same thing. But there's kind of an unspoken general belief that while instinct comes from the physical unconscious, say like the fear of falling or the fear of loud noises or the survival instinct, that it's easier and automatic the way it happens, that intuition is non-physical. It's in the non-physical unconscious areas. So it's harder to access, and it's even suspect to being real. Like you say, people think we're imagining it, or how do we know we're imagining it? But the cognitive, what I call the cognitive faculty of imagination, is real, and this realness depends on how we use it and how we align our way of thinking with and about it. So intuition and instinct are both unconscious. The idea is, probably with physical instinct, it's very difficult to become conscious of it. It's going on a sub-level in the parasympathetic systems and with the limbic part of the brain. Intuition seems to be information that's coming from the outside. So what you said at the beginning is we question it. Questioning it is probably the best way to access it, because that means we're becoming aware of it instead of ignoring it. Some people will ignore it or go into denial or have been taught to just push it away, that this is too subtle to be real. But the more we focus on it and give it time, because it's very subtle, it slowly gains more solidity, as it were, so we can start feeling it in a way. And it's not something that we generally feel through our physical senses, although some people do feel an intuition. Like I say, I feel a tingling in my spine, that kind of a thing. So the body is also part of that as well, too. So there's a whole way of becoming more attuned and aligned with our mind-body system and questioning it and saying, what's going on here? Let's explore. Let's not be afraid. Let's do some research. Let's ask questions. So the more information you get, the more able you're to access it. So it's having those qualities, again, of being open, aware, unafraid, curious, having a sense of awe, thinking, wow, this is really wonderful. And maybe having someone to talk to about it who's not going to criticize you or judge you or laugh at you in any way, but will actually ask, like I would, oh, wow, that's great, tell me more.
Yeah. You know, I read an interesting research study, and it addresses people who stated that they do not believe in the that the mind can act independently of the body. They didn't believe in telepathy, they didn't believe in intuition, they didn't believe in survival. And the question was whether or not they ever have gut feelings. And a large percentage of this population, something like 75-80%, said, yes, they have gut feelings all the time, which I thought was kind of amusing, you know. They admitted that the gut feelings they couldn't explain. And they didn't believe in it, but yet they had them. So I guess a gut feeling would be in the intuition category.
I would say for sure, yeah, because the mind and body are part of the same biosystem. So whichever, some people can access their intuition easier through their gut feeling and others through other ways.
Yeah. Let's talk about a little bit about... I know a term that you use is that, you know, we're dominated by our ego mind, and that's contrasted by another part of us, you know, which is the authentic self. So when we talk about an ego mind, I mean, how would you define that?
Oh, do you have a few hours?
Yeah, I know.
it's not anything new, really. I mean, it's sort of part of our culture about talking about the ego this and ego that. And I've come to this understanding of this through my own work, my own spiritual work as well, too. So it was not something that came to me overnight, and I'm still struggling to understand it, because it's sort of like trying to understand yourself at the same time. It's part of the mind, and it seems like it began very soon after the dawning of human consciousness, when humans began to say, I am, and became aware of being aware. And the ego mind's original main function was and is to act as a kind of buffer against the tremendous amount of information coming at us through our physical and other senses. It's like a filter, because there's all these senses coming in, stimuli coming in from everywhere, and we would be too overwhelmed by it, and we would just short circuit. And so the ego mind is there to filter it, and it kind of has to make decisions about what it feels we need to know and don't know in order to help us survive. Otherwise, we'd be too distracted by too many things, and probably, you know, it'd fall off the cliff we don't know we're walking near. So this includes the physical senses that are coming at us, sight, sounds, smells, but it also includes the use of emotional, what I call astral etheric senses and energy coming from other dimensions. There's a lot of invisible wavelengths, like we think of x-rays, and, sounds we can't hear. The ego mind is also dealing with things on higher sensitive levels. So it's an analytical holding area. It filters and monitors all incoming localized sensory information and some non-local information, and it helps decide what we need to be aware of for basic physical survival without shorting us out by an overwhelming excess of information. And it was designed, or I'm saying designed, it seems to be designed to be a cooperative effort with the body. So this is the mind-body, and together with the body and the ego-mind, they can make faster-than-light decisions about the information in such a way that our self-awareness, this I am that I talked about, or what I call the authentic self, can move about in our material body. The interesting thing about it is it also seems to have its own intelligence. Like, people say that our body parts have their own intelligence and our organs have their own intelligence. This ego mental component seems to have an intelligence of its own, too. And as near as I can figure out, quite early on, the ego mental part began misconstruing its function as a result of, I guess, observations of the body's built-in biological self-preservation instinct. So it started withholding information to gather energy for itself. It did this because it figured out that when the body stops functioning or dies, the ego mind's function will also end. And it doesn't survive into what we might call an afterlife, and it knew this. So it started utilizing the brain to help shape the form of this energy it was gathering for itself into what we call critical thought. So this kind of decision-making became separate from our mind-body, and it manifests as judgmental thinking. It, for most of us, it continues to inappropriately analyze thought beyond its initial duties, and it tries to take on aspects of our authentic self. So our goal in terms of ego mind is not to get rid of it because it's part of us, but to try to reappropriate it and use it as the tool that it's there to help us become aware of. But most people are dominated by it. It uses fear.
And if you're dominated by the ego mind, I would imagine that you would most likely view death as permanent.
You would view death as real. As well, too.
So would you, as we recognize more and more of our authentic self, some people might term that as enlightenment. I mean, would you go that far with if you learn to recognize the authentic self, you become more spiritually aware and therefore more enlightened?
Yeah, it gets very difficult to try to put any of that in language when you're speaking in terms of words. Because words sort of separate us from the actual experience. But, yeah, it's like an awakening. We're awakening, realizing that I am, I do exist. And some people call that enlightenment. I'm not sure if that's what it is.
Well, then, so it's feasible that maybe if you believe in a design in the universe, I mean, maybe that's our purpose. Maybe we all come into this world dominated by ego mind, but true growth comes by recognizing
our immortal self. So I guess that's something that certainly you have written about, and I would imagine you would agree.
Sure, yeah. I have this, my understanding is that we are immortal, and immortality is not something that we're going to achieve or get when we die, but that we're already living an immortal life. And that's kind of a radical concept. But you can find that in almost any and every major religion or spiritual foundation about immortality. They put it in different words. Seems to me
we're
going to
we'll continue more after the break, but I did want to mention the fact that you did write a book called The Risen, and the book was authored under the name of August Goforth, and Timothy Gray, and that was for obvious reasons. You do have a professional practice, but yet it may be time and perhaps spirit directed that the two be integrated. And what our listeners may not be aware is that you also have mediumistic abilities. Personally, I think this gives you a tremendous advantage, and I'm happy that you're working in the mental health field, because I think that you can serve to be a beacon for future professionals as they can do a lot of help for their patients. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about that at the break. So stay with us, and when we come back, we will have more with David Yonkin. And again, the website is davidyonkin.com. We'll see you in a few.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net, Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world, but for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential, and research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The Sign Registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you are just tuning in, our guest tonight is David Yonkin. This show is sponsored by Equine Muscle Massage Therapy by Jan Barson, and she can be reached by phone at 631-862-1402. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to our show, we have a few important foundation updates for our listeners. Here at Forever Family Foundation, we are sending out a big thank you to our supportive listeners who have made possible this past year of bringing Signs of Life Radio to you. They know that even though we are a 100% volunteer not-for-profit organization, it still takes a lot of money to do the work we do. And yet, we know that not everyone has extra income they can send along to support the continuation of our programming. So this is how easy it is to keep this radio show alive without sending us money. Go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that's taken out. And each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. Then, if your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com. But first, use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website. And again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up for iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we receive a donation. And when you find what you are looking for, and there are more than 900 online stores like Sony, The Body Shop, Vera Bradley, Vistaprint, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. How to Listen When Your Children Speak was an afternoon workshop for parents who have lost children. It took place this past Saturday in Bethel, Connecticut, with certified medium Angelina Diana opening to bring through only 10 children in spirit. We want to thank Angelina for a very meaningful and moving day. Anyone wishing to contact Angelina directly can find her on the web at angelinadiana.com. Our annual November conference is set for Phoenix, Arizona at the beautiful Hilton Phoenix Airport Hotel with free shuttle service to and from the airport as well as to local attractions. And this conference will be the first of its kind as an intensive interactive weekend. Make your arrangements and reservations now as the hotel block is filling up. The weekend will begin with our annual Friday night fundraiser on November 9th featuring Long Island medium Teresa Caputo, and will continue through November 10th and 11th with a select group of esteemed scientists answering your deepest questions about the reality of the spirit world. The weekend also features certified mediums Dave Campbell and Deborah Martin, who will be joining our panel of expert presenters, Dr. Evan Alexander, Lloyd Auerbach, Dr. Julie Beischel, Dr. Stafford Betty, and Dr. Claude Swanson. 12-12-12, don't miss being in the right place on the most spiritual date of the year. 12-12-12 is a medium marathon featuring an evening of four extraordinary mediums, Bobby Allison, Kim Russo, Siri Bernstein, and Laura Lynn Jackson at Long Island University CW Post in Brookville, New York. Seats may be reserved at the website at foreverfamilyfoundation.org on the events page. And Holidays Past this year will be in four locations: Natick, Massachusetts with medium Joanne Gerber, Pompton Lakes, New Jersey with medium Janet Nohavik, Bethel, Connecticut with Angelina Diana, and Melville, New York with star of Emmy-nominated TV show The Afterlife, medium Suzanne Northrup. Please visit Forever Family Foundation's website for dates. These are all Saturday nights in December, and to make your reservations. Back to you, Bob.
And thanks for hanging in there. We are back with our guest tonight, David Yonkin. You know, before the break, I did mention that that David does have abilities to communicate with spirit. And I was thinking of you this week, David, because I had finished up another book that was written by a medical doctor who also is a medium, and it talked about his struggles as he would be counseling or examining a patient, and a discarnate entity would appear. And I would imagine that you go through similar circumstances, or maybe not. I mean, did the spirit make an appearance when you're working with a patient?
Sometimes. It's pretty rare. And sometimes a person who is discarnate is concerned about a loved one here, either because of their grief or mental instability or whatever is going on, and they'll influence them to seek out a therapist, and they'll actually steer them towards me or maybe someone like me. And I'm very much aware that there's more than just me and the patient in the room, but there's also someone with them in various ways that I can see clairvoyantly, sometimes hear clairaudiently, and I can sense very often. And they usually are just there to make sure that the person's going to stay, or they just want me to acknowledge, know what's going on. And they never really say anything. They don't give me any kind of information. I just am aware that this is the person's father or their person's mother or some kind of a relative. And they just hang around a little bit just to watch and make sure everything is okay, and usually just leave and never come back once they just see that they got the person in the place. Perhaps they can't come back. Maybe they only had a one-shot deal to get the person to come. But so there's not someone who's discarnate sort of pitching in and trying to take over the session or add their two cents. That itself is very rare. But I often get a lot of information from them. They'll give me access to information if I want, just to confirm certain things, or that they're worried that this person may not be telling me, but they may be thinking about suicide, and so that will prompt me to ask that question, or they may prompt me in other ways to do it. But basically, I'm in charge. And it's interesting, too, is they always, I've never been tempted to say, oh, by the way, you know, your dad's in the room with you. That would just be very inappropriate, and there's all kinds of ethical situations around that, and it's not the point. But sometimes they seem worried. I mean, they want to make it very clear that I should not tell their loved one that they're in the room. They don't want them to know. It's very clear that they just want me to be very quiet about that and not share it. But oftentimes the patient will start talking about the person, which confirms for me about the discarnate's presence. But I don't say, oh, it's funny you should bring that up because I just saw them here. I don't do that. I just use that as information for myself. So it helps me know what to do moving forward, just gives me more information in working with them.
That's interesting, you know. So in effect, you know, people in spirit sometimes will be guiding you, you know, versus their loved one in the room, you know, so because they know that you need as much assistance as you can when dealing with their fragile loved one. So that is an interesting concept.
Yeah.
So the boundaries are clear, but you know, they are. I guess you use the information in the context of your professional ability as a psychotherapist, right? I mean, so I just see this as a tremendous advantage that you have over many of your colleagues. Do you envision, an environment in the future where your colleagues in the mental health field, they either integrate, you know, mediumship into their practices, or they refer evidential mediums as part of a therapy process?
I didn't used to, but increasingly I'm starting to see that. One of the reasons when I wrote that book or co-wrote that book under a different name of many reasons was for ethical reasons, and I really didn't want to draw attention to me because it wasn't about me. It was about something else the book was written entirely about. But since the book was published 3 years ago, I've shared the book with a few close colleagues and who know me quite well, and they really haven't batted an eye. And then they started telling me about their experiences and their own sensitivities, and they hadn't yet really developed a language on how to talk about this professionally because no one has been doing it in that way. So there's a lot of work to be done in terms of education and study. It brings up all kinds of ethical concerns about certification and licensing and who's held accountable and abuse and inappropriate behavior, all that kind of thing. So I think it will be a while, but it seems also that a lot of people, it's just coming out naturally. Like there's certain, I'm aware of a few therapists around the United States, they're coming out as mediums as well, and they're developing their own practice around their own modality, and they're, you know, it's kind of a brave, courageous thing to do, and everyone's doing it in different ways, so we're kind of in the pioneering part of it now, I think, at least in the United States.
And I know that you've kind of taken a lead in that. You've written some interesting papers on the subject, and that could possibly serve as a model if you can get it through the right channels. I mean, the one thing that's clear to me is that if one believes in an afterlife, that it's helpful to the grief process. I'm certain that you've found that in when you treat patients, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I guess a follow-up to that would be, can you give any type of an indication in numbers? I mean, if you see 50 people that are grieving the loss of a loved one, when they come to you, would you say half of them believed in an afterlife and half of them didn't?
It's a real, real mixed bag. Every person is very individual, and their experience of loss and grief is very individual. And it's next to impossible to try to pigeonhole them in any kind of organized way. And yet, because I know everyone has, they're starting from this common shared experience of grief, it's important for them to know that I've had that experience too, that I've gone through this sense of loss, because until you've gone through that loss, no one really understands it or gets it. So you need that kind of resonant support of care that understands it. And so I have a lot of, I'm not afraid to ask certain questions if it seems, you know, based on my assessment of the person's stability in the moment. At some point, I can actually ask, well, where do you think they are now, or what are your beliefs about that, to open up the question. And sometimes there are certain people I just know intuitively that I can ask a question like, well, do you feel that they're still around you in some way, or are you still having conversations with them? Do you feel the relationship is still going on in some way? Because grief is a very living process, even though we think it's about the dead. It's a living process, and we're still alive, and they're still alive. So we're trying to introduce this idea of a language to get people to talk about it in some way. And that brings a lot of strength, to be able to get it out of yourself and talk about it in a kind of a way. So I envision certain modalities in that direction.
And, you know, the book we're talking about is called The Risen, you know, and there is a website, therisenbooks.com, and we won't get into much of it, you know, today, but it does contain a tremendous amount of profound channeled information. there's one thing that, you know, in the book that I had copied, and I'd just like to read it because it is very interesting and informative. And when we talk about the risen, we're referring to, you know, to people in spirit. So some information that came through to you, you know, as risen, we won't be dead at all, but more alive, conscious, and aware than ever before. We'll be free of the immense gravity and spirit-numbing effects our materially dense earth bodies had been continually bearing upon our spirit. We will learn to move, live, and love in the astral body we had been carrying all along within our densest material one, and which had not been evolving, or not, according to how much we focused on its evolution. You want to comment on that a bit?
You know, that kind of says it all.
Yeah, I know. It really does. And I mean, that, it's been a while since, you know, I read the book. I mean, was that, you know, channeled from Tim, or was that from, you know, a group of risen people?
From a group, actually, and yeah. It took over 8 years to get together. It was a very long, arduous process trying to put it into words that made sense. And so I really see myself as just the discerner or the messenger, or a lot of it. I still read the book because I still am studying the material that came through. Some of it's very interesting, profound, and some still a little confusing. And it was proposed to Tim, who was my partner in life, who died or transitioned some years ago. And it was like an experiment, and there was a group of risen people, I guess you would call them. They just refer themselves as the Risen Collective, and it was about over 1,500 beings on their side who were collaborating in this project, and that included scientists and various multidisciplinary groups, I would call them, who were interested in getting this material for various reasons, obviously, towards my practice and disseminating it. And
I know we're reaching the end of our time, but one important question from your perspective and experience, I mean, do the people in spirit, do they continue to take an active interest in our development? Or are they off in other directions?
All of the above. Some
okay.
Some do, and some don't. Some really worship the earth as their birthplace and stay very connected to it and are interested in studying, because it's so much. Our earth is so much more complicated and complex than we know. And there are other people who are risen who would just prefer to forget about it, like it was a bad dream, and have, you know, glad to be rid of it. And there are even some who, I think I've told you before, they're skeptics. Like, they don't believe that there's such a place as Earth, that it ever existed. It just sounds too, they've totally forgotten about it, and it was like a bad memory or bad dream, and they just think it sounds so crazy there couldn't possibly be a place that it existed.
I know, it's pretty crazy when you think about it, right? We live in a dream world.
Uh-huh.
Well, we've unfortunately reached the end of our time. We have been talking with David Yonkin. His professional psychotherapy website is davidyonkin.com. If you'd like to learn more about the book we were talking about, The Risen, the website is therisenbooks.com. David, thanks so much for joining us, and we hope to speak with you again soon.
I hope so. It was a great pleasure.
All right. Thank you, and have a good evening.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Stanley Mullen, Julie B., Chase McKenna, Elizabeth McKenna, Glenna Irwin, Barbara Petillo, David Hayes, Rita Springer, CJ, Eileen LaFada, Mark Zarin, Wendy Lippo, Vicki Steffi, Nancy Scheel, Barbara Russell, and Diane Archangel. Now let's give energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures by praying like this. to the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, planktons, coral, algae, and all creatures in our Earth's waters. I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. That was from the original Gulf Water Prayer by Mosura at the Moto back on May 9th, 2010. And now it's time to say...
Our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.